this week's program, a conversation with Yannick Nuzet-Séguin. The Philadelphia Orchestra has released details of its music director designate's first season. David Patrick Stearns profiles Tasman Little. The highly regarded British violinist is in Philadelphia to help celebrate the 150th anniversary of Frederick Delius. And we speak with soprano Yulia Van Doren. The Baroque specialist makes her Philadelphia recital debut tomorrow. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Earlier this week, the Philadelphia Orchestra announced details of its first season under its incoming music director, Yannick Nuzet-Séguin. The season will place a strong focus on choral music, with opening week featuring a stellar cast in the Verdi Requiem. Season highlights include a multimedia presentation of The Rite of Spring for its 100th anniversary, a season-long tribute to legendary music director Leopold Stokowski, culminating in a concert of Central European music, and Yannick's debut with the orchestra at Carnegie Hall. The orchestra will also play a number of dates at the Academy of Music, its first subscription concerts there since it left for the Kimmel Center a decade ago. Over 9 weeks in Philadelphia, Yannick will also conduct a family concert, a multimedia educational concert, and an audience choice program, projects usually left to associate and guest conductors. And while Yannick is looking forward to building on a century plus of the orchestra's traditions, he says he's also looking forward to imprinting his own artistic stamp.
I think that this is mainly what a music director should be doing at the beginning. And this is, in a way, what I've been doing, giving glimpses of it in my two seasons as designate. Now it was my time to program for the first time. And it's two things. It's first respecting and honoring the tradition of the orchestra and how do I fit in this tradition. But also it's keeping my own baggage as a musician and making it relevant to the Philadelphians today. And choral music is my origin in music. And it always, even if I would try not to program choral music, I wouldn't be able. It's a reflex. It's something that I value a lot. And it's not only because I love it. It's mainly because I feel that these pieces, like the Requiem of every composer we've been playing and that we will with Verdi next year, is very often in choral music that you find the masterpieces, very intimate masterpieces of these composers. So that's why my reflexes go there. And it's, I believe, something which will give a different angle and a new part of a new face to the repertoire of our orchestra.
You say baggage, but you bring also some remarkably talented people as part of that baggage. Rene Fleming for opening night, and then, I mean, a superstar cast for the Verdi Requiem.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great that these people responded so spontaneously. You've mentioned Rene, who I've been working with for quite a few years now, and she is, of course, revered and respected and admired and loved by the entire country here. It's a real statement of hers to come for the opening night. It's a statement of the reputation of the Philadelphia Orchestra and, of course, to the friendship that we have in music, her and myself. Also, this cast of the Verdi Requiem with Marina Poplavskaya, who's been at many of my Met productions. Rolando Villazon, who's back in really full vocal shape.
Because there were some real problems there, right?
Yes, there were. And
he actually retired at one point, didn't he?
Well, not really retired, but he had to stop twice for a full year because of physical problems really related to the vocal cords. He had three operations, and now it's really back. I can tell you that we're in for a treat with him.
You've just recently been recording with him, right?
Absolutely, recording, and more concerts are planned. And, you know, for a music director to arrive, I think there's this aspect of who has been shaping my ascension here. And definitely those people that we're mentioning are part of my recent past and therefore my present and my future here in Philadelphia. But also what interests me in this season is bridging also with the artists which have been featured here and have their own following here. I'm talking about Josh Bell, Gil Shaham, Hilary Hahn, with the Curtis Connection. These are three artists, to name only three of them, who are absolutely wonderful and whom, for various reasons, I haven't performed with yet. So I will do my first times here in front of my audience here in Philadelphia. So that's what I like about the season, is that it's not only what I'm comfortable with or who I am comfortable with already, but it's always good, I think, for an audience to witness the first meeting of two younger artists like Hilary and me, for example, and that will happen here in Philadelphia.
It's notable that there aren't that many major debuts, either conductors or soloists, during the season. And a lot of the people who are here, they are audience favorites with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Was that deliberate?
Of course, every season will be different. But this one, the new element is me. And it's not that I wanted to remain the only new face, but when we balance all the elements, it's important to, for the conductors, for example, it was very important for me to know and send a message to the orchestra and to the audience that, yes, there is a new person coming and I'm bringing with more weeks than originally planned, actually. But it's also that my way of thinking is that I don't want to have it like a revolving door of new people, new one guest conductor after the other, and you get many debuts and some people. We want to organize it more as partnerships. So there's quite a few conductors who will be there for two consecutive weeks, for example.
Simon Rattle for one.
Oh, yes. Well, Simon, I'm so happy. We are all so thrilled that he's still keeping us as his only North American presence. And he has very few anyway, besides the Berlin Philharmonic. He's almost conducting no other orchestra than the Philadelphia Orchestra, which is a testimony and a statement of what he thinks of us. So that's fantastic. But we have also Raphael Fribeck de Burgos, who's a real favorite of the orchestra and the audience. He's also touring, a short tour to Florida with the orchestra. More recent discoveries as well in terms of how the musicians and the audience enjoy people in particular. I'm thinking of Gianandrea Noseda. I'm talking about also Jaap van Zweden. So these are Stefan Denev. So these are all people I wanted to make sure that there would be this stability. After a few years of search,
because we did see a lot of new faces,
yeah,
in the process.
Yeah, exactly. After a few years of search, it's normal that we have to go a little bit the other way to keep the balance right. But of course, there will be many more debuts in future seasons. But this is all a question of balance.
We've spoken before, and you talked about the relationship you had with this orchestra, and indeed other orchestras as a guest conductor, that it was a kind of meeting of DNA, that the conductor brought his interpretation to the orchestra, and the orchestra brought, if it was a piece of standard repertoire, they brought their interpretation to the conductor. And you seemed happy to go along with that. Now you're the boss. How much of it does it become more of your DNA and less of theirs, or does the relationship change?
I wouldn't say it's more and less, but there's definitely more exchange. It needs to be not what about my vision or their tradition, but more of a new sound. We are writing a new page in history. It's not up to us to say what it is exactly in history, but it's up to us to say, okay, this is what Yannick and the Philadelphians will create as their sound. In a few years' time, I would like people to recognize what is the sound result of their DNA and mine together. So it's true that even in the previous weeks here, with the Brahms Requiem and then with the Italian program and the Russian one, I got to work much more in depth than I had the previous season. I took charge very much. And that doesn't mean that I'm negating what was the tradition. But it's up to me to say, okay, from now on, we will have this goal and this purpose. We'll work on this aspect. And musicians actually like that I'm voicing this so that they know. And, okay, let's, for a few months, years, work on this aspect together. And that gives us a common artistic project, which obviously and hopefully will get fantastic results that will also be our stamp in history.
Is there something in the season that says, this is an indication of who I am musically now, and it's also my sense of what the tradition of the orchestra I'm taking charge of is?
Yes. Well, what I would like everybody in the audience to see and to get from this season is that my programs and the season as a whole, because it has been really taken care of and curated in function to have ties and connections between all the programs, but that the whole would be the image of who I am now as a musician. However, it's true that there's one program which I'm especially proud of, and I can't say that it's maybe the most core repertoire of myself, but it's the last one in the season, which is the Central European one, with the Janáček Sinfonietta, with the Slavonic Dances of Dvorak, with Brahms' Violin Concerto, and Enescu Rhapsody. This is a designed program to, as a tribute to Stokowski and the way he would have programmed it this way. And we don't program a violin concerto like the Brahms anymore in the second half with a shorter piece at the end with a certain connection because of this Hungarian theme to have something then Romanian and Czech and Hungarian as well. So I believe that this is really something to give a tribute, but yet it's not imitating him. It's more has more to do with who we are in 2012, 2013. So in that sense, yes, that's a good indication that no program will be predictable from now on at the Philadelphia Orchestra. And this is very much where I am as an artist now, and that what I want people to remember.
So could we potentially be losing the short piece, overture, concerto, intermission, symphony? Could we be losing that format completely?
No, there's a few programs here which there was actually no other choice in a way. There's the program with Mahler Symphony No. 1 in the second half. I wanted to pair it with some Kongold, so we have the Kongold Violin Concerto. Then it's so short, one needs a little overture. So you end up logically with overture, concerto, symphony. There's still a great connection between the three pieces. So yes, there's a few in this, so I won't, of course, say that it's abandoned, but there will be less and less, or at least there will be no program which you have trouble finding what's the connection between the pieces.
The Rite of Spring is a staple for this orchestra, and you're taking that on again in its 100th anniversary season. But a couple of questions. One, it's with the Ridge Theatre of New York, which is not a dance theatre. They do sort of multimedia and opera. So that's question one, number one. What will they be doing? What will their part be in it? And two, there's no mention in this information I've been given about any dancers being on the program. So
There will be. Yeah, there will be. It's the Ridge Theatre is actually partnering with some dancers. They do visual effects. They do lighting. They do also projections, whether it's on a scrim or projections which are on the surface of the hall. So it's the first time that we will really be using Verizon Hall as a, and not only the stage,
as a medium,
yes, to imagine and create an atmosphere around the Rite of Spring. There will be some dancers, but it would have been way too predictable to have it only as a ballet, because it is a ballet to begin with. But for us, it was always to remember, okay, when Stokowski took Rite of Spring, roughly 15 years later, to America for the first time, that was a groundbreaking act in itself to do. If we are to honor the Rite of Spring as one of those groundbreaking moments and add it to our history of being a groundbreaking orchestra, what we need to do is something which is slightly different than only recreating a ballet. So this is why this also is something, a project which is really to my heart, because I won't reveal too much of it, but it's a great project where the orchestra will be in dialogue with the visual element. So the orchestra won't be as a background thing or something.
Because that does scare people. When you start using symphony orchestras cinematically, people get upset.
Yeah, it also makes me upset when the orchestra is not the feature of it. On the other hand, I believe that these enhancements help inform us, and I've said it, enhance the whole concert experience. especially for works which had been designed to have a visual aspect to them. And for some people who are really allergic to it, there is still the Rite of Spring that we do one night with a pure concert version of it, with another pairing, which we do Schumann Spring Symphony, you know, easy match. And that's also one keyword of this season. We are varying our offering very much. Our target to some people who really want some traditional programming and traditional way of putting the pieces together, that's fine. They will still, of course, have their place, and we are still there for them. But we're also there for an audience which is more interested in a slightly different way of presenting the music we play. So the music we play is still masterpieces, but the way it's put together makes a big, big difference.
You talk about varying the offering, and you're doing something that's slightly different than what many music directors do in major orchestras. You're doing things like conducting family concert, you're doing a Beyond the Score concert, you're doing things that normally one of the assistant conductors gets to do. Why?
I believe these projects are all part of why the orchestra is relevant to a community. And as we want to put Philadelphia through the Philadelphia Orchestra back into the minds of the international community as one of the absolute top ensembles there is, we also want the Philadelphians to remember how great we are, and we want them to feel close to us. And there's no other way than showing also from the music director that I consider that going into the community, conducting summer events, conducting for children, and explaining the programs, the post-concert conversations that we've been starting so successfully now, some pre-concert conversations as well. So I think it is my duty, but also my pleasure, because if I want to welcome everyone, I also feel that I should be everywhere.
Yannick Nezet-Sagan. He begins his tenure as music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra in October. He'll conduct his first Academy of Music concert this evening.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Violinist Tasman Little has the fingers to play anything and the career to play almost anywhere. Yet on Sunday, the woman who is widely considered the finest British violinist of her generation is making a special trip to America to play at the German Society of Philadelphia on Spring Garden Street, and doing so for the sake of a composer whom she has championed for most of her adult life, Frederick Delius. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns visited Little at her London home and discovered that her love for Delius is a model for other quixotic causes in her life.
Music this beautiful should not go unheard, and yet it does. Perhaps because the beauty is too relentless to handle over the course of a full-length concerto. In fact, when Tasman Little walked into the 1983 Yehudi Menuhin International Violin Competition playing this piece, the Delius Violin Concerto, she knew she was giving up any chance of winning first prize.
It was worth basically waving goodbye to the first prize because it's not flashy enough. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but my reward for knowingly depriving myself of a first prize was that I did get an opportunity to play it with the orchestra. So I suppose that it actually didn't matter because, you know, you go in and hope to win a competition in order to get opportunities. Well, I got the opportunities even though I didn't win it. And I still got to play the work that I really wanted to play.
And it's not as if Delius is easy on the fingers. And he was a violinist himself.
He didn't allow this knowledge to influence him or allow him to just go easy on a player.
What's on the page was only the gateway in Tasman Little's journey into the heart of Delius. She was one of the first violinists to champion his early violin sonata, one that was only discovered after his death and shows the composer at his most carefree. That's hardly the quality one hears in his music only a few years later. As a young man in the 1880s, he talked his father into funding an orange plantation in Florida. Artists aren't always good at running businesses, and Delius was no exception. So he left Florida for further musical studies, but upon returning years later, he learned there was more unfinished business than he thought.
I believe that he had this love affair with a black girl in his early time in Florida, the girl fell pregnant and he didn't know about this. And he only heard about it approximately 12 years later. And he never saw her and he never saw his child. And it's very interesting that his music changes very markedly at this point in time. The mood of loss and regret that I think colours so much of his music, that all happened around about the same time.
Tasman Little plays the more typical and more heroic concertos of Brahms and Beethoven as masterfully as the best of them. Nonetheless, she's made it a point of specializing in concertos with alternative logic. She plays the Janáček Concerto. She loves Max Bruch's almost entirely unknown Violin Concerto No. 2. Her 70-concerto repertoire grew slightly bigger with Wolfgang Riem's dense, ultra-modernistic Dritte Musik, which she played last year in Amsterdam. It represents the polar opposite of Delius's prettiness. Repertoire is just one point of risk in her life. The other is venues. Spring Garden Street in Philadelphia may not be everybody's favorite part of town, but it's nothing compared to the prisons where Tasman Little plays as part of her outreach activities. A documentary film about her seen on England's South Bank show illustrated how remarkably at ease she is under circumstances that others might find terrifying.
More. Okay, right, more. Yeah, give me some ideas, everyone.
It's a bit of Oasis.
I'll do it if you sing it.
They wanted to hear my music, but they wanted to interact with me as well. And that was the bit that I was happiest about.
One venue that has been tough for her to crack is the United States. She's played here only sporadically and often on tour with visiting orchestras. Her last Philadelphia appearance was with the Berlin Philharmonic under Simon Rattle in 2003. Of course, Tasman Little has plenty to do. She often plays in the Far East, seems to be on the BBC all the time, and, as a divorced mother of two daughters, has much to keep her occupied at home in London.
If somebody wants to get me over to the States, it's not easy. You know, you have to go to the embassy and have your fingerprints taken, and the actual expense of the visa is one thing. And then, of course, I've got to fly over there as well. I've got to stay in a hotel and, you know, so I'm expensive to employ.
There's also a prevailing attitude in England, I heard it several times during my visit, that America has so many fine musicians of its own, why import British ones? But even in classical music circles, where many musicians play the same repertoire of great masterpieces, the way to play them comes in endless varieties. But you might not know that when you're hearing young musicians coming from the same American conservatories with the same teachers. If audiences keep having the same experience with the same pieces, they might not come back. Is it possible that we need musicians such as Tasman Little a little more than they need us?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Accompanied by pianist Akira Iguchi, Tasman Little will help the Delia Society of Philadelphia celebrate its 35th anniversary and the 150th birthday of Frederick Delius in a concert at the German Society of Philadelphia at 611 Spring Garden Street tomorrow afternoon at 3. Although comfortable in multiple genres, soprano Yulia Van Doren's specialty is Baroque repertoire, and that is, in the main, what she'll be singing in her debut Astral Artist recital at the Trinity Center for Urban Life in Philadelphia tomorrow afternoon. Born in Russia, Van Doren grew up in Carlisle, PA, one of seven children, all homeschooled by an American father and a Russian mother, both of whom were professional musicians.
So I grew up in a very, very music-intensive house. I was actually a pianist, and I played a lot of Bach. So Bach was really in my blood, but I went to New England Conservatory for undergrad. In my sophomore year, my teacher was named Loretta Bybee. She was doing the Ring Cycle in Seattle over the summer, and I wanted to study with her. And so I decided to go out there for a month and just take lessons. And someone told me, you know, there's this 10-day Baroque program there that you should audition for. I don't know what it is. I don't know who it is. And I thought, why not? I'm going to be in Seattle. And long story short, it's a program called Accademia d'Amore, run by Stephen Stubbs, who will be accompanying me on this recital. He's a fantastic lutenist and Baroque guitarist and conductor. And he had just moved back from Germany after 30 years, and he has this 10-day workshop. And that was my first experience singing Baroque music, and I just really took to it. You know, I've never gone to school for Baroque singing, And in the Baroque world, it's not that that's unusual, but there are a lot of training programs. There's, you know, a lot of people who do Baroque singing get a master's in it or in historical performance, and I don't have that. So it has been learning on the job, which has sometimes been very intense.
But when instrumentalists are discovering Baroque music, there's a lot of attention paid to the instruments on which it was originated. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing the human voice hasn't changed that radically over the centuries. So what's the area of specialty that's involved for vocalists with taking on Baroque music?
I honestly think it's a mindset. Baroque singing has been, I don't know if progressing is the right word, but now basically all the big opera houses are doing Handel opera, and Baroque music is really, really, I mean, look, Enchanted Island at the Met, it's everywhere. And those aren't people singing with tiny voices. Those are people who can sing any type of repertoire. And I really do think it's, you know, the reason you sing straight tone is to bring out harmonies. Because when you have a vibrato, you have two notes happening at once. And so if there's a really kind of juicy harmony, and Baroque music's full of that, you just straighten the tone out for a minute so that that's really highlighted. Whatever emotional message is behind that interval that the composer chose, that's really highlighted. So that's the purpose for straight tone.
You sing other stuff, though, right?
I do, yeah. I'm really busy professionally singing Baroque music, so that definitely fills my time, but I love... I really love new music. You know, Don Upshaw is a sort of mentor and inspiration for me. I studied with her in grad school. So I love new music, and I want to do much more of that. And I love Mozart. I'm hopefully doing my first Mozart opera next year, and I want to sing everything. But Baroque music's so much fun to sing. You know, my dad's a jazz pianist, and my fiancé is a jazz musician, and you get to improvise. I think you should improvise in all music. You know, now we tend in bel canto to sing the same ornaments which someone sang back 100 years ago.
And listen to the recordings to hear that we're exactly, doing it right.
Exactly. It didn't used to be like that. And I do think I'm guilty, too, of writing out ornaments. But it should all be improvised on the spot. And I do think it's moving more that direction as people get more, I don't know, brave and less worried about... I don't want to say less worried about what's right and wrong, because I think it's very important to respect history, of course. But I do think it's very important to take it off the page and make it spontaneous and personal. So,
you talk about the fact that there is, you know, Baroque opera at the Met, but it's the exception rather than the rule. For a soprano of your age, the normal goal is that famous stage in New York City, mm-hmm. the Metropolitan Opera, but that's not your end game.
No, I mean, if I get the chance to sing at the Met...
Oh, sure, you'll return their calls.
I'll call them back, of course. But for me... It sounds really hippy-dippy, but I really want to keep my eye on making sure I'm doing music for the right reasons, which to me is to bring good things into our world. I guess that's not really a way to say what is my goal, but it's just to keep doing good work, good, honest work, and try to be original.
Soprano Yulia Van Doren. Accompanied by Stephen Stubbs on lutes and guitars, she makes her Philadelphia recital debut tomorrow afternoon at 3 at the Trinity Centre for Urban Life at 2212 Spruce Street. The concert is presented by Astral Artists. And that's our programme for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.